Our program tonight is entitled Public Health Versus the Nanny State. And as you may know, our two speakers tonight are the journalist Jacob Solomon and the economist Tom DiLorenzo. For those of you who have not seen their respective books, Jacob is the author of the widely acclaimed book For Your Own Good, which is this one here. And Tom's most recent book is this one here, which is co-authored with Jim Bennett, called From Pathology to Politics. I also want to point out the Institute published a book a couple years ago, which is directly germane to our topic tonight, which is called Taxing Choice. And one of the issues that is a major feature of the so-called nanny state is the use of taxes as a predatory form to punish people or to drive them away from certain kinds of behavior. Other forms of the nanny state, of course, include regulation, prohibition, lawsuits of different types, and so forth. For those of you new to the Institute, hopefully you got a packet when you registered, and you'll find information about our books and upcoming events. In there, you'll find a flyer about tonight's program, and it also mentions that our next policy forum, which will be held on November 15th, is entitled Gun Control, Separating Fact from Myth. The program will feature the criminologist Gary Kleck, who's professor of criminology at Florida State University, and is the author of the acclaimed book Targeting Guns, Firearms and Their Control. Gary comes from a liberal background, and as a criminologist, he discovered that these policies are not exactly producing the ends that people thought, and that perhaps firearms use in a private manner is beneficial to those trying to protect themselves. The program will also feature David Koppel, who's the research director of the Independence Institute in Colorado, and is editor of the book Guns, Who Should Have Them. So we hope that you'll be able to join with us then. Barely a day goes by without some news of the latest public health threat or feeling of such a threat. Serious health hazards, we're told, lurk around virtually every corner, in water supplies, in the air, in soil, beverages, food, marijuana, cellular phones, secondhand smoke, food irradiation, not to mention TV and movies, the internet, video games, and so on. And yet Americans today live longer than ever, and crime rates continue to drop. People ranging from Jerry Falwell on the right to Ralph Nader on the left are major proponents of the nanny state. Such views stem from the fears over and opposition to the peaceful practices and peaceful choices of consenting adults regarding all manner of things. The crusades against smoking, hamburgers, alcohol, fossil fuels, as I mentioned, video games, and much more recently, a whole series of things that pertain to topics like global warming and so forth, seem to reflect, as Mencken suggested, a kind of crusade against the simple joys and conveniences of modern life. For example, although public opinion supports the legalization of medical marijuana, and states and communities around the country continue to pass measures supporting such reforms, powerful interest groups and government agencies refuse to recognize these changes. However, this fall there are seven states with measures pertaining to drug issues on the ballot, and most of them will probably pass. In fact, in total, there are 204 measures up for election in 42 states this election year, and most of them pertain to some aspect of personal choice and the nanny state. Let's, for instance, consider some of the restrictions on the average home today. Just recently, the Consumer Product Safety Commission has requested that baby bath seats be banned because this safety product allegedly instills a false sense of security in parents, who may then leave their babies unattended and expose them to the risk of drowning. Not only is there no evidence of any design flaw in any of these baby bath seats, but this proposed ban is being made because bath seats for babies are apparently considered too safe. Too safe in luring parents to be less attentive. In other words, increased safety is now just too risky for the public and must be stopped. Furthermore, if a ban on baby bath seats were made, it turns out that baby drownings would most likely increase, since only 9 children using bath seats drown per year versus 41 who die annually from bathtub drownings without a bath seat involved. So should safer technologies then be limited by the nanny state? Who benefits? Many of you may also know the absurdities of the ongoing federal restrictions on the size of toilets in the U.S., resulting in less water used per flush. However, since the effective use of such toilets requires on average more than one flushing, the total amount of water used has increased since the adoption of these toilets. Also just recently implemented, the Department of Energy's new energy and water standards for water washing machines will increase the cost of front-loading machines by $200 and top loaders by $800. To meet the new standards, manufacturers must start selling more efficient front-loading machines instead of the more popular top loaders. Even though front loaders don't wash as well, can't be opened during the wash cycle, and take longer to do the job, using precious water, of course. Meanwhile, governments themselves massively subsidize energy use, water use, energy development, and electric power transmission and distribution, resulting in enormous waste, waste that can't even come close to washing machine use. Is this kind of government policy really in the public interest, or are markets and private decision-making providing the real answers? Are these dangers real, immediate, and a legitimate threat for ever-expanding government regulation? Can we eliminate health risks without government controls? How does politics distort perceptions about public health? Will Americans succumb to, or will they rebel against the growing nanny state's neo-Puritanism and attack on individual choice and responsibility? Our speakers tonight will discuss many of these very timely and important issues. Our first speaker is Jacob Sullum. Jacob is a senior editor at Reason Magazine and a syndicated columnist for Creators Syndicate. Mr. Sullum received his bachelor's degree in economics and psychology from Cornell University. He's a fellow of the Knight Center for Specialized Journalism. Mr. Sullum is the recipient of the Keystone Press Award for Investigative Journalism and first prize in the Felix Morley Memorial Journalism Competition. In 1988, his article on pain treatment for Reason was a National Magazine Award finalist in the public interest category. His book that I mentioned before, For Your Own Good, was Amazon.com's number one public policy bestseller in 1998. He's also been articles editor for National Review and as a newspaper reporter for the News and Courier Evening Post in Charleston, South Carolina, and the Times Leader in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. His many articles have also appeared in National Review, Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and elsewhere. Jacobs is currently working, incidentally, on a new book on the moral issues involved in drug policy and drug use. I'm very pleased to present Jacob Sullum.
Thank you. In the spring of 1998, when the tobacco companies said they would no longer cooperate with the effort to pass a federal anti-smoking bill, the Clinton administration said it didn't really matter. We will get bipartisan legislation this year, Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala told NBC. There's no question about it, because it's about public health. As it turned out, Shalala was a bit overconfident. But her prediction was certainly plausible, given the way politicians usually behave when the term public health is bandied about. The incantation of that phrase is supposed to preempt all questions and erase all doubts. It tells us to turn off our brains and trust experts like Shalala to think for us. Given that expectation, it may seem rude to ask why exactly smoking is a matter of public health. It's certainly a matter of private health, since it tends to shorten one's life. But lung cancer, heart disease, and emphysema are not contagious, and smoking itself is a pattern of behavior, not an illness. It is something that people choose to do, not something that happens to them against their will. if smoking is a matter of public health and therefore subject to government control, then so is any behavior that might lead to disease or injury. And in fact, public health officials nowadays target a wide range of risky habits, including not just smoking, but drinking, overeating, failing to exercise, owning a gun, and riding a bicycle without a helmet. Even gambling, which has no obvious connection to morbidity and mortality, is a matter of interest to public health researchers. In short, there is no end to the interventions that could be justified in the name of public health as that concept is currently understood. Although this sweeping approach is a relatively recent development, we can find intimations of it in the public health rhetoric of the 19th century. In the introduction to the first major American book on public health, U.S. Army Surgeon John S. Billings explained the field's concerns. Whatever can cause or help to cause discomfort, pain, sickness, death, vice, or crime, and whatever has a tendency to avert, destroy, or diminish such causes are matters of interest to the sanitarian. Despite this ambitious mandate, the public health movement of the 19th and early 20th centuries dealt primarily with the control of infectious diseases. This was accomplished through a variety of measures, including improved sanitation, cleaner drinking water, eradication of mosquitoes and other disease carriers, isolation of contagious individuals, vaccination, and the use of antibiotics. Such methods were strikingly successful, dramatically reducing death rates from illnesses such as measles, scarlet fever, cholera, smallpox, diphtheria, whooping cough, pneumonia, and tuberculosis. Nowadays, public health textbooks discuss the control of communicable diseases mainly as history. The field's future and present lie elsewhere. One textbook, Principles of Community Health, explains that the entire spectrum of social ailments, such as drug abuse, venereal disease, mental illness, suicide, and accidents, includes problems appropriate to public health activity. The greatest potential for improving the health of the American people is to be found in what they do and don't do to and for themselves. Individual decisions about diet, exercise, stress, and smoking are of critical importance. Similarly, Introduction to Public Health notes that the field, which once had much narrower interests, now includes the social and behavioral aspects of life, endangered by contemporary stresses, addictive diseases, and emotional instability. Public health used to mean keeping statistics, imposing quarantines, requiring vaccination of children, providing purified water, building sewer systems, inspecting restaurants, regulating emissions from factories, and reviewing drugs for safety. Nowadays, it means, among other things, raising cigarette taxes, banning alcohol billboards, restricting gun ownership, forcing people to buckle their seatbelts, and making illegal drug users choose between prison and treatment. In the past, public health officials could argue that they were protecting people from external threats, carriers of contagious diseases, fumes from the local glue factory, contaminated food, food poisoning, contaminated water, and dangerous quack remedies. By contrast, the new enemies of public health come from within. The aim is to protect people from themselves rather than from each other. Americans no longer live in terror of smallpox or cholera. Despite occasional outbreaks of infectious diseases such as rabies and tuberculosis, the fear of epidemics that was once an accepted part of life is virtually unknown today. The one major exception is AIDS, which is not readily transmitted and remains largely confined to a few high-risk groups. For the most part, Americans are dying of things that you can't catch: cancer, heart disease, trauma. Accordingly, public health specialists are focusing on those causes and the factors underlying them. Having vanquished most true epidemics, they have turned their attention to metaphorical epidemics of risky behavior. The evolution of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is emblematic of this shift. Established during World War II, do you know what the CDC originally did? What its original mission was? It was a unit of the public health service that was charged with fighting malaria in the South. Today, the CDC includes 7 different centers, only one of which deals with its original mission, the control of infectious disease. The CDC's growth can be seen as a classic example of bureaucratic empire building. More generally, it is easy to dismiss public health's ever-expanding agenda as a bid for funding, power, and status. Yet the field's practitioners argue, with evident sincerity, that they are simply adapting to changing patterns of morbidity and mortality. But in doing so, they are treating behavior as if it were a communicable disease, which obscures some important distinctions. Behavior cannot be transmitted to other people against their will. People do not choose to be sick, but they do choose to engage in risky behavior. The choice implies that the behavior, unlike a viral or bacterial infection, has value. It also implies that attempts to control the behavior will be resisted. In 1979, the Surgeon General issued a report called Healthy People, in which he noted that formidable obstacles stand in the way of improved public health. Prominent among them, he said, are individual attitudes toward the changes necessary for better health. Though opinion polls note greater interest in healthier lifestyles, many people remain apathetic and unmotivated. Some consider activities to promote health moralistic rather than scientific. Still others are wary of measures which they feel may infringe on personal liberties. However, the scientific basis for suggested measures has grown so compelling, it is likely that such biases will begin to shift. In other words, people engage in risky behavior because they don't know any better. Once they realize the risk they're taking, they will change their ways. But what if they don't? In the case of smoking, self-styled defenders of public health seem genuinely puzzled by the fact that so many people persist in this plainly irrational habit. They insist that people smoke not because they like it, but because they were tricked by advertising and enslaved by nicotine before they were old enough to know better. Scott Ballen, at the time chairman of the Coalition on Smoking or Health, once told me, "There is no positive aspect to smoking. The product has no potential benefits. It's addictive, so people don't have the choice to smoke or not to smoke." Hence, smokers who acknowledge the risks of their habit but cite countervailing rewards are dishonest or deluded, displaying the classic defense mechanisms of rationalization and denial. The sociologist Ann Wortham, herself a smoker, says tobacco's opponents believe that if you smoke, you are in a state of false consciousness, because you are not aware of what is in your interests. It's the refusal to acknowledge people's capacity to make choices. You just define them out of the picture, out of the discourse. Addiction says they can't even talk about their own likes and dislikes. We can decide for them. Now, Ann Wortham is not the only one to be rebelling. Even after the public is informed about the relevant hazards, and assuming that the information is accurate, many people will continue to smoke, drink, take illegal drugs, eat fatty foods, buy guns, eschew seatbelts and motorcycle helmets, and otherwise behave in ways frowned upon by the public health establishment. This is not because they can't help themselves. It's because for the sake of pleasure, utility, or convenience, they are prepared to accept the risks. When public health experts assume these decisions are wrong, they are treating adults like children. That tendency is apparent in the rhetoric of the anti-smoking movement. Although more than 90% of smokers are adults, the best-funded anti-smoking group in Washington these days is called the, you know what, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. During the 1998 debate over tobacco legislation, it ran ads, these were on the New York Times op-ed page, maybe you've seen them elsewhere, with the headline saying, "Every day, without action on tobacco, 1,000 kids will die early." Now, I don't know about you, but I had to read that a couple times, and it conjured up images of fifth graders dying from lung cancer, 12-year-olds keeling over with heart attacks in the cafeteria, and high school sophomores with emphysema wheezing as they climbed the stairs on the way to their next class. As commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, David Kessler also tried to infantilize smokers. "Nicotine addiction," he said, "is a pediatric disease that often begins at 12, 13, and 14, only to manifest itself at 16 and 17 when these children find they cannot quit. By then, our children have lost their freedom and face the prospect of lives shortened by terrible disease." Now, this label, the pediatric disease label, also reflects the public health tendency to pathologize risky behavior, thereby obscuring the role of individual choice. From a public health perspective, smoking is not an activity or even a habit. It is the greatest community health hazard, the single most important preventable cause of death, the man-made plague, the global tobacco epidemic. It is something to be stamped out, like polio or scarlet fever. Treating risky behavior like a contagious disease invites endless meddling. The same arguments that are commonly used to justify the government's efforts to discourage smoking can easily be applied to overeating, for example. If smoking is a compulsive disease, so is obesity. It carries substantial health risks. People who are fat generally don't want to be. They find it difficult to lose weight, and when they do succeed, they often relapse. When deprived of food, they suffer cravings, depression, anxiety, and withdrawal symptoms. Some can be quite serious. Sure enough, the headline of a March 1985 article in Science announced obesity declared a disease. The article summarized a report by a National Institutes of Health panel finding that the obese are prone to a wide variety of diseases, including hypertension, adult onset diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, hypertriglyceridemia, heart disease, cancer, gallstones, arthritis, and gout. The panel's chairman said, "We found that there are multiple health hazards at what to me are surprisingly low levels of obesity. Obesity, therefore, is a disease." So, we got that. If it causes a disease, it is a disease. Now, since then, the obesity epidemic has been trumpeted repeatedly on the front page of the New York Times. One of the first stories came in July 1994. It was prompted by a study from the National Center for Health Statistics that found the share of American adults who are obese, and that's really fat for laymen, increased from a quarter to a third between 1980 and 1991. "The government is not doing enough," complained Philip Lee, an assistant secretary in the Department of Health and Human Services. "We don't have a coherent across-the-board policy." A New York Times story that was published the next year reported on a New England Journal of Medicine study that found gaining as little as 11 to 18 pounds was associated with a higher risk of heart disease. Or, as the headline on the jump page put it, "Even moderate weight gains can be deadly." I'd like reading that over your breakfast. The study attributed 300,000 deaths a year to obesity, including one-third of cancer deaths and most deaths from cardiovascular disease. The lead researcher said it won't be long before obesity surpasses cigarette smoking as a cause of death in this country. Just this month, you may have noticed, the Times ran a series of lengthy front page articles reminding its readers that the fat epidemic is still with us and only getting worse. You are probably part of this epidemic, by the way, since most of us are fatter than the experts say we should be. According to a survey that was done a few years ago, three quarters of Americans exceed the weight range recommended for optimal health. At the American Obesity Association's first annual conference held last year in Washington, excessive weight was described as a national emergency, a worldwide epidemic, and a ticking time bomb in the healthcare system. Surgeon General David Satcher called it a major public health problem that deserves much more attention than it receives. What sort of attention, you might ask? Well, as early as June 1975, in its Forward Plan for Health, the U.S. Public Health Service was suggesting strong regulations to control the advertisement of food products, especially those of high sugar content or little nutritional value. Today, people like Kelly Brownell, who I love, by the way, because he gives such great quotes, he's a professor of psychology at Yale University, and he directs the Center for Eating and Weight Disorders at Yale. People like Brownell have taken up this call for censorship. "A militant attitude is warranted here," he told the New Haven Register. "We're infuriated at tobacco companies for enticing kids to smoke, so we don't want Joe Camel on billboards. Is it any different to have Ronald McDonald asking kids to eat foods that are bad for them?" Brownell has also suggested taxing foods based on their nutritional content. Foods with a high ratio of calories to nutrients would be taxed heavily, while fruits and vegetables might be subsidized. In 1998, U.S. News and World Report included this proposal, which it called the Twinkie Tax, on its list of 16 silver bullets, smart ideas to fix the world. And they were not joking. That same year, The New Republic published an article by Hannah Rosen in which she chided alarmist commentators, like me, I guess, who had criticized the notion of using taxes to encourage better eating habits. Aside from Kelly Brownell and a couple of other academics, she said, very few people were taking that idea seriously. One of them, it turned out, was Hannah Rosen. "It's too bad Brownell isn't more popular," she wrote. The rest of her article was devoted to explaining why a Twinkie tax was not such a crazy idea after all. Now, a tax food, you probably see already perceived this problem. A tax on junk food would be paid by thin people as well as fat people. So it might be more fair and efficient to tax people for every pound over their ideal weight. Now, this is a market-based system, because it would make the obese realize the cost that they impose on society, and it would give them an incentive to slim down. If they didn't want to lose weight, that would be okay. They could just pay the tax. Now, if that idea strikes people as ridiculous, it's not because the plan is impractical. In many states, people have to bring their cars to an approved garage for periodic emissions testing. There's no logistical reason why they could not be required to weigh in at an approved doctor's office, say, once a year, and report the results to the Internal Revenue Service for tax assessment. Although feasible, the fat tax is ridiculous because it's an odious intrusion by the state into matters that should remain private. Even if obesity is apt to shorten a person's life, most Americans would agree, I hope, that's his business. That's the fat person's business, not the government's. Yet many of the same people believe not only that the government should take an interest in whether a person smokes, but that it should apply pressure to make him stop, including fines, also known as taxes, tax-supported nagging, and bans on smoking outside the home. New York City lung surgeon William Cahan, a prominent critic of the tobacco industry, has explained the rationale for such policies. People who are making decisions for themselves, he said, don't always come up with the right answer. Now, the dangers of basing government policy on that attitude are pretty clear, especially given the broad concerns of the public health movement. According to the textbook Public Health Administration and Practice, public health is dedicated to the common attainment of the highest levels of physical, mental, and social well-being and longevity, consistent with available knowledge and resources at a given time and place. Now, if that's not broad enough for you, Principles of Community Health tells us that the most widely accepted definition of individual health is that of the World Health Organization. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. A government empowered to maximize health, then, is a totalitarian government. In response to such fears, the public health establishment argues that government intervention is justified because individual decisions about risk affect other people. Motorcyclists often contend that helmet laws infringe on personal liberties, noted Healthy People, the 1979 Surgeon General's report. Opponents of mandatory helmet laws argue that since other people usually are not endangered, the individual motorcyclist should be allowed personal responsibility for risk. But the high cost of disabling and fatal injuries, the burden on families, and the demands on medical care resources are borne by society as a whole. This line of reasoning, which is also used to justify taxes on tobacco and alcohol, implies that all resources, including not just taxpayer-funded welfare and health care, but private savings, insurance coverage, and charity, are part of a common pool owned by society as a whole and guarded by the government. As Robert Meenan, a professor at the University of California School of Medicine in San Francisco, noted in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of decades ago, virtually all aspects of lifestyle could be said to have an effect on the health or well-being of society, and the decision reached that personal choices should be closely regulated. Writing a few years ago in the same journal, Faith Fitzgerald, a professor at the University of California at Davis Medical Center, observed, "Both healthcare providers and the common weal now have a vested interest in certain forms of behavior previously considered a person's private business. If the behavior impairs a person's health, certain failures of self-care have become, in a sense, crimes against society, because society has to pay for the consequences." Most public health practitioners would presumably recoil at the full implications of the argument that government should override individual decisions affecting health, because such decisions have an impact on society as a whole. But former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, who became famous as a foe of tobacco and now is campaigning against obesity, and I haven't seen any pictures of him lately, by the way, but he was pretty chunky when he was in office. And I don't know if he's taking care of that or not. And I guess I can say this here. I'm not sure if this is too mean to say. Kelly Brownell is pretty chunky, too. I don't know if that's fair to bring that up, but it seems to be kind of like an anti-smoking activist who smokes. Koop does not seem to be troubled by the implications of this approach. "I think the government has a perfect right to influence personal behavior to the best of its ability if it is for the welfare of the individual and the community as a whole," he writes. Koop thus implies that the government is authorized to judge the welfare of the individual, and he elevates the community as a whole above mere people. Now, some defenders of the public health movement have given this a little more thought, and they explicitly recognize that the aims of public health are fundamentally collectivist and cannot be reconciled with the American tradition of limited government. One public health professor gave a speech back in 1975, which summed up pretty well the obstacle posed by the tradition of limited government. He argued that the radical individualism inherent in the market model is the biggest obstacle to improving public health. The historic dream of public health that preventable death and disability ought to be minimized is a dream of social justice, he said. We are far from recognizing the principle that death and disability are collective problems and that all persons are entitled to health protection. He rejected the ultimately arbitrary distinction between voluntary and involuntary hazards and complained that the primary duty to avert disease and injury still rests with the individual. He called upon public health practitioners to challenge the powerful sway market justice holds over our imagination, granting fundamental freedom to all individuals to be left alone. Public health, in other words, is inconsistent with the right to be left alone. Of all the risk factors for disease or injury, it seems, freedom is the most pernicious. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jacob.
Thank you, Tom.